Brother Christian Cobb, will you stand and lead us in a word of prayer? We'll get started this evening, please.
Well, first, Heavenly Father, I come unto you today, Lord. Thank you so much for your word, your truth, Lord, and this opportunity to dig into the scriptures here, Lord, to dig out some of these deeper things. Lord, I do pray our hearts and minds are open enough to receive these things, Lord, take them home, study them out, apply it to our lives. Particularly, search the scriptures. Just pray that you be with Doug and the rest of the teachers tonight until class continues on. That you be with their lessons of being prepared. Let's use them later on in our heart. Right now, that's why I say in Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you. Baptist Church history in early America. The Welsh Tract Church, one of five that came from Wales, England, to the United States, the one that most of our lineage runs through, in Delaware. The Welsh Tract Church, named that way from the tract of land that was deeded to them. Interesting, and I thought I'd find the records of at least two or three of the churches. The one in Hopewell, New Jersey, that's listed, as well as the Welsh Tract Church, were deeded that land from William Penn, who the state of Pennsylvania is named after. As influential and important as he is, a lot of some charters, lands. We see the histories of especially Rhode Island, direct contracts, or, and that's even more what the tract is in the Welsh Tract Church in early histories, contracts that were granted him by especially William Penn, the land of most of what is Pennsylvania and a lot of the Jerseys and Delaware, and they're in the Northeast, granted to that family of William Penn that he then deeded to, gave to early Baptist churches. We talked about date of that Welsh Tract Church here in the United States. It came over as a congregation from Wales, England, in 1701, the next major date historically was the founding of that Philadelphia Association of Churches, the first major Baptist association that's recognized. A lot of other Baptist churches, some of them that came from England, other places, before that time. But the Philadelphia Association from five churches that most probably even knew each other, were familiar with one another before they came here to the United States, all of them from Wales. There were associations with them that before coming over here that writer John Christian recognizes and speaks about in this book. They organized by way of associations gathering together at least in annual meetings, sometimes a little bit more often than that, but annual meetings to encourage and not necessarily to pool together. They were very much independent in their congregations and their activities, but they fellowship one with another, and that was pretty important. Other associations that came up after that, even what's listed in most of the church lineage record that we have, even as local churches here in the United States, from really the next major one as far as associations go is the Warren County Association in Kentucky. Dates for that come up late in the 1700s, so probably not for another generation or two of time, but that church, particularly in Warren, Kentucky, one of the churches that are our lineage goes back through. We talked about an individual very active in that work and even starting the church there in Kentucky, and where was that one? Providence Church of Warren County, Kentucky is the proper name of it. It was a man by the name of John Gano, American Baptist minister, soldier. He was one of George Washington's first chaplains in the Revolutionary Army. There are early pictures of paintings of John Gano baptizing President Washington. Debated today and doubted, but as early as that picture is, I find very little that was ever, people made that kind of an attempt to document that wasn't real and actual and didn't have something to go along with it. And because of the closeness that President Washington had, even though it's doubtful that he ever became a strong Baptist dedicated in the churches, just being associated with and the rapport and the respect that he had for John Gano and his work among Early Baptist churches during that time, I think, is pretty significant. Was ordained out of that church in Hopewell Township, New Jersey, in 1754. That's where he was born, right within that same area. Most of his early life took part right there. He's almost more well known for being the one of the major chaplains in that Revolutionary War, taking a very active part even in the fighting. He was there at Washington's, reportedly at Washington's crossing the Delaware that everybody's so familiar with, as well as being a confidant and an officer in George Washington's army. And almost every town today in the United States, you can find a First Baptist Church somewhere, can't you, just by name? The First Baptist Church in the city of New York, and that's how it was known and recognized, because it was the First Baptist Church, was pastored by this John Gano. Okay. That's just some of the prominence and other historical things about him that I find pretty significant. It was asked about, just as I was closing class last time on Friday night, whether this John Gano is one of the same ones that historically recognized having been beaten, particularly because of his stands. And I said at that time that I thought probably so. There were still beatings going on, but I tried to find the last couple of weeks since we had that class, and I can't find anywhere where significantly where that took place. Not with him. The most prominent time historically, and there were a lot of Baptists that were flogged for, beaten for their faith during the 1600s and 1700s here in the United States, colonies at that time before 1765, right? 1770, 1774, whenever everything was, when independence was seen and realized. The most commonly known, though, I think at that time, was by a man that was named, let me get his exact name here. Last name was Holmes. He ran around with the John Clark that we've talked about from Providence, Rhode Island. Obadiah Holmes, yes, thank you. And that was in 1668. As much as I can find the date, at least within a few years of that time. And from laws that came out of, and because they were at that time at that church in Providence, Rhode Island, but had members and would go into Massachusetts, which was very Episcopalian at that time, and where there was a lot of harsh treatment among Baptists. They would be fined, they would be jailed, sometimes beaten very severely, as Obadiah Holmes was. And that, as I stated in about the mid-1600s when that's recorded. When I brought up the name George Washington before, though, I think he may be one of the more well-known historical figures before the founding of the United States that came from what state? Virginia. Okay. That was one of the, that is recognized historically now as then. Massachusetts was one of them. But Virginia, another one that had the harshest laws and prohibition of Baptist churches. And I want to go back to the last chapter in the first volume of Christian's history and deal with that just a little bit. about, well, be easier, this is closer toward the end of the chapter. I'm about 5 or 6 pages back when it talks about, there's a chapter that starts out the Bloody Militia Code of 1611. I'm going to read a lot of that paragraph right there. Because, and I've got a lot of interest too, just about early Bibles and early, but what is the year 1611, 1612? Why is that significant? Yeah, that's when the King James Version came out in England. But at the same time, a lot of this persecution, a lot of the involvement, a lot of the activities among Baptist churches. Now, again, this close to 100 years before John Gano, even before the Welsh Tract Church came over in early 1700s. But I'm sorry, Brother Dale. In my version of this, it's on 381. It's just after that account. If it's marked, it's just across the page from that whipping of Obadiah Holmes. If you can find that around the next page.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. It starts out the Bloody Military Code of 1611. But there was a law that was in Virginia, interesting enough, and especially for me. I mean, I think when I introduced this class, during that same decade, both in England and the United States, there was so much going on and so much history that wasn't necessarily connected, but happening at the exact same time, interesting enough. So here in Virginia in 1611, the first published for the government of the colony, it was called the Military Code. One of the first things that they did as a government of a colony wasn't even so much to set up taxes, it was to prohibit any other churches than the Episcopalian Church. That was the state church at that time. I'm going to back up just a paragraph or two for this. I won't read the one before that, but if you're on that same page with me, two paragraphs above, Virginia was a great battleground for religious freedom because of persecution and those that were fighting against it more than anything else. The colony was founded by members of the Church of England, and none others were tolerated in its jurisdiction. And then in that paragraph where I started a minute ago, the Bloody Military Code of 1611, the first published for the government of the colony, first one that was copied and gave out to everybody within the colony so that they would know what was going to be enforced and what was most important to them. It required that every man and woman in the colony who should afterwards arrive, migrate into Virginia, to give an account of their faith and religion to the parish minister, the state church, the Episcopalian priest. And if not satisfactory to him, they should repair often to him for instruction. This was the law. And I'm emphasizing this because we think separation from church and state means that the church isn't supposed to have influence on what it originally meant to everybody, and especially in the colony, is that the governments were imposing religious persecution and religious order among all of its citizens. You could have been an atheist. You could have just denied and not went. You know what? There are many people who were jailed just because they didn't go to church. That's how oppressive. We think, no, it couldn't be that way here in the United States. That's how oppressive many of the colonies were in the early days. Okay? I'm going to back up just a little bit and read some of this again. Every time someone would arrive into that colony to give an account of their faith and religion to the parish minister, the Episcopalian priest, and if not satisfactory to him, that they should repair often to him for instruction. They would have to go to him daily, if not weekly, to receive instruction if they didn't give a testimony and commitment of their faith to the Episcopal Church. And if they refused to go, the governor could whip the offender for the first offense For the second refusal, be whipped twice, and to acknowledge his fault on the Sabbath day in the congregation, on their day of meeting. And for the third offense, be whipped every day until he complied.
Wow.
That's how strong religious persecution was in Virginia. 100 years before George Washington came on the scene, but the very same state. Okay. That's how strong the hold of religious persecution was in the colonies. And a page or two over, let's see, I'm on the next page now, almost halfway down the page. Cox, an historian of the Episcopal Church of Virginia, gives this statement: no dissenters in Virginia experienced for a time harsher treatment than did the Baptists. There may have been Catholics, there may have been Quakers, there may have been Jews. Okay, but this is an Episcopalian historian. No dissenters experienced harsher treatment than did the Baptists. They were beaten and imprisoned and cruelly taxed. It's ingenuity to devise new modes of punishment and annoyance. The usual consequences followed. Persecutions made friends for its victims, and the men who were not permitted to speak in public found willing auditors in the sympathizing crowds who gathered around the prisons to hear them preach from grated windows. Okay. They didn't have the second and third story, and sometimes there's grated windows in their prisons, but people would gather together to hear them preach, even knowing that that's why they were there. Okay. Just the conflict among even the Protestants at that time and what Baptists experienced by their own testimony. On the next page, about halfway into that next paragraph, there are at this time in the adjacent county not less than 5 or 6 well-meaning men in close jail for publishing their religious sentiments, which in the main are very orthodox, very conservative. There were Baptists, though, who, because they refused to submit to and go along with the parish minister, the Episcopal priest, they were subject to not only the fines and beatings, but the imprisonment. Accordingly, and even as late as 1766, I've skipped a paragraph and gone down in this page. Accordingly, in 1776, the Baptists were enabled to place upon their records that the bill had been passed, and in their judgment, their religious and civil liberty were duly safeguarded, but this simply suspended the old laws of persecution. Federally, in 1776, there was the statements of religious freedom, but the individual states, just like many are doing today, fighting against, they're not going to tell us what to do even as states, they still continue the practice of persecution, especially among the Baptists. That's the early experience. In that last chapter of the first history of Christian, a lot of good stuff in there about what our Baptist forefathers went through. Would be good to see and recognize that, spend more time with that. Probably the last I'll look at it this year. I know we've only got a couple of more weeks of school, but a couple of statements then about, and I want to go back just a little bit to John Clark and the church at Newport, Rhode Island. I'm going to go to the second book of the second volume of Christian's History to chapter 2. And a couple of pages into that, toward the bottom of one of the pages, page 42 in mine, the very last paragraph and reading into the next one or two, describes what some of the communications among the colonies were, especially in Rhode Island, where John Funk was, that started the First Baptist Church organized. Not Roger Williams. They were contemporaries. Roger Williams' church never amounted to anything and didn't even last during his lifetime. This church in Newport, Rhode Island, where Clark was, did, and was a very influential church, both of them very conservative and influential in their state government at that time. About this time, a church was organized in Newport, Rhode Island, by John Clark. Massachusetts and Connecticut, says Richard Knight, have both passed laws that no persons except members of the established churches should be admitted free men. They couldn't vote and they couldn't carry on commerce in those colonies. Okay. Within their jurisdiction of Massachusetts and Connecticut. The Baptist churches being settled in Providence and Newport in 1644 in Rhode Island, the Massachusetts government was so fearful that their principles would spread into their colony that they passed a law in November of 1644, November following, so late in that same year, that if any person or persons should within their colony openly condemn or oppose infant baptism, because the Episcopals, that was their practice, everyone who is born would be baptized and part of their church. We know that as a Catholic practice, right? So did the Episcopals here in the colonies. That any person within the colony that should openly condemn or oppose infant baptism or seduce others from the approbation, the practice thereof, or should leave the meeting house purposely at the performance of the ordinance, if they were there and dismissed themselves while infant baptism was going on, because it was expected that everybody in the colony be there within the city that was where the church was. Every such person or persons should be sentenced to banishment. They would be kicked out of the county, have to fend for themselves. How? They were rejected and denied. That was part of the level of intolerance and persecution. This intolerance led Clark and his associates to select Newport as a proper place for a church of their own in Rhode Island. Okay, even though they started there in Massachusetts also. Felt places the organization of this church in Newport in the year 1644. Dr. John Clark, founder of this church, was a Baptist minister before he came to America. He was educated at the University of Leyland in Holland. Holland was as much and more a bed of Baptist separatists, even more so than England. Okay, during much of this time. It's also reasonable to assume that he was a member of or in fellowship with the Baptists of Holland, who had as early as 1611 affirmed the right of all men to religious liberty and the duty of obedience to lawful government. And so they preached that and taught that, just like Romans chapter 13 tells us to submit to. But at the same time, to know and recognize that religious liberty was opposed to that. I use it fairly regularly in some of my teaching, not necessarily not about history, nonetheless. I did just the other day when I was speaking from behind the pulpit from the book of Josh Daniel, I guess, in the third chapter. What did the Hebrew children tell Nebuchadnezzar? We're not even careful how we're going to answer you in this matter. We're not going to bow down to you. What did the apostle say in the fifth chapter of the book of Acts? Look yourself. Who are we to obey? We ought to obey God rather than men. Okay, that's the same stand and the same thing that was going on here. But did anybody catch the date I read there? As early as 1611 in Holland and England. At the same time, those things are going on in the United States in just the year of, if not months or a year before, the King James Bible was completed, and probably before a lot of it being mass-produced and readily available. And so they're affirming the right of all men to religious liberty and the duty of obedience to lawful government. That almost seems to be a contrast, especially when the government is doing the persecuting and writing laws against religious liberty. But they are teaching and promoting all men to obedience to lawful government. At the same time, the government's persecuting them. Boy, that's an interesting distinction among Baptists, isn't it? One of Dr. Clark's biographers states that he attained high repute for ability and scholarship in languages, including Latin, Greek, Hebrew, law, medicine, and theology from his schooling in Holland. In theology, Dr. Clark accepted and taught the doctrines of particular, they say, of Calvinistic Baptists in opposition to Arminians. But just because he was so conservative and taught salvation by grace, even through faith, not necessarily Calvinistic the way we hold to today, but salvation by grace, not what was so common and popular, especially among the state churches of those days. No, you become a church member, you gain entrance into heaven when you're baptized as an infant and a child. They denied that. They wouldn't baptize them. That's why, and remembering, not only in England, in the colonies, in Holland, now we've got record of this at the same time going on. That's what that's what separated the Baptists from everybody else. Okay? Those doctrines, practices, that is salvation. But one of the reasons why we've emphasized so much even the practice of baptism and anabaptism or rebaptizing, we rebaptize today almost anything that's alien, and so did they, but that's almost overshadowed completely. The only thing they were known for, really rebaptizing for, was their converts as adults who had been baptized, and that's where all the attention and the persecution came from. For if you baptize somebody after they were baptized by the Church of England, you were denying and rejecting that, and that's why they took opportunity. That's why they made laws then, because you were a dissenter. You were a defier of the government. That's one of the reasons why they made it such a point to promote obedience to the government, because they were being accused of, and many times historians will not recognize and not give account to how often they promoted and how often they affirmed the duty of obedience to lawful government. They had reason and purpose to emphasize that. Brother Daniel.
With laws like that, talking about Virginia, you could see why there wouldn't be, like we have, so much other religion baptisms, because the only people that would, they'd all be, quote, Episcopalian at that point. So the only thing we really would oppose would be the infant baptism.
For decades at a time.
You wouldn't have other churches sitting there like we have.
There were other Protestants, and the Reformation had gone on, but Brother Daniel's exactly right. The oppression was so hard that not only were Baptists not allowed in Massachusetts, and why is Massachusetts so big? It's a big city in Massachusetts, and some even wanted the national government to be there in Boston, the big city then at the time where all the port was. And that was almost became the capital of the United States. If they would have had their choice, it probably would have been. But much of the emphasis of the colonial, not only persecutions and laws and interactions, but because of its close relationship with Rhode Island and John Clark, Massachusetts, there's a lot of history about that, okay? But I'm going to continue some in. Over half a century, how much on this do I want to... I thought I wanted to... Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and I'm on page 76 now in that second chapter. And the first full paragraph, in circumstances like these, I'm going to drop down just a couple. Well, I'll read that paragraph. They're talking about the influence of the Baptists, the meetings of the Baptists. Circumstances like these, says Neal in his address on the 200th anniversary of their church. For over half a century, they stood alone, their Baptist forefathers, and bore the responsibilities and the whole weight of theological odium which rested upon the Baptist name and the name and cause in the colony of Massachusetts. There were some Baptist churches who stayed on the outside and in the shadows and amongst the trees. Remember what we read about the church at Hillcliff there in Wales? They were stuck back in and had quick access and would run every time there was persecution, but it didn't stop them from meeting, even in that one locale, for many generations. Okay. There are some that hit out in Massachusetts also, yes.
Do we know what year the first church, Baptist church in Massachusetts came around?
Yeah, it's in that chart on the first paragraph. Give me just a second here. 1633. And it was from Swansea, Wales, interesting enough. Yeah. In the same year, the first Baptist church in Boston is seen and recognized. It was just called the first Swansea church because the churches that came over from Wales kept other names than particularly Baptist. Well, there were two of them in that same year there in Massachusetts. Okay. Brother Dale.
So you said 1633.
Yeah.
So I'll read it to you.
Okay.
The complete separation of church and state was not guaranteed by the Constitution of Massachusetts until 1830.
Until 1836. 200 years later,
we can't even fathom 200 years. 200 years later, a lot of fighting, and they got it in their constitution 200 years later.
Yeah. After, and not only that, but it gives evidence of what I made mention of a couple of minutes ago. Even though federally it was stated, and some in the federal government tried to enforce and impose that upon the states, the states were just independent enough that they knowingly had and still kept their persecution of the churches until, when did you say, 1860?
1833. The Constitution was finally changed.
Were they on paper? Yeah, they're in the state of Massachusetts, correct? Thank you. Thank you. They were separated. Okay, they must have had and did have this Baptist church in Massachusetts during the first 70 years of their experience, a very painful sense of isolation. They were separated from their brethren in England. No sister churches were in their neighborhood. No Baptist associations, as now, with letters and delegates. No pleasant countenances or kindly words to cheer or sustain them. Reverend John Miles, and this from the mid-1700s, who had recently immigrated with a remnant of his flock from Wales, was at Swansea. I'm sorry, no, this John Miles and Swansea Church goes all the way back to the 1600s. I that I dated. Sorry for having to correct myself. And occasionally made a visit to Boston, and sometimes a good brother or two would come up from Rhode Island and the Providence plantations, where the church in Providence and John Clark was. But in general, our brethren were shut out from public sympathy and lived in constant dread of their emissaries of the government. They had spies, the priests of the church, the governors, mayors and councilmen were all opposed to them. And many of them, not only enforcers, but those who would do all they could to carry out these laws and to turn in the Baptists. They met in houses of the different members of the church at Charleston, Noodles Island, and Back Street, now Salem Street, until the erection of their first sanctuary in 1679. So this is much before that. I wanted us just to get a glimpse of, for me, think even during COVID that we were being persecuted. It's nothing like what this was. I mean, we had it hard and there were some tense things going on. I don't want to deny or dismiss that. But it's not anything like what this was that was constant. And that was a dark cloud, and there was a threat every time they got together, not just in, when it finally come to it, we can do it with less than 20 people, right? They wouldn't allow that to go on. That's why they are talking about it here, sometimes in members' homes or in the suburbs and outside of the city, because the threats were that real to them. Brother Jacob.
Well, I'm not going to, like, you know, there's sluggishy and stuff and all that, but she worked. The things that any of folks went through with them because of our stand for Christ. Each brother, everything they're going through is because of the stand they had.
Yeah. And I'm already taking time, but I wanted just to get another glimpse of that. We'll open our Bibles tomorrow and go back and look at baptism like we have before. But I wanted us to get more glimpses of that. Anything else I'll use will come out of the second volume now. If you haven't read through at least the second or third paragraph or second or third chapter of Christian's second volume, a lot of good history in there still of the colonies before we became the United States of America. Brother Dale, have your hand up, or are you just talking to Brother Mike with your hands?
Sure. If you were, you start off about the land being donated, right? And then you should name the name church more time. They received the land, you said, from William Penn.
Oh, that was the Wealth Tract, the church in Delaware.
Now, some people are not aware of this, but William Penn, father, who served in the Royal Navy for England, according to Christian Bringer, was Baptist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, that land was donated
to Baptist churches, at least, and to numerous of them.
I'm not going to get into the William Penn thing, and there's some stuff there.
Yeah.
But he knew.
He knew.
He knew the truth.